we need to talk about ideas, good ones and bad ones. We need to learn stuff about the world. We need an honest, intelligent, thought-provoking, and entertaining review of what the hell happened on this planet in the last 7 days. We need to sit back and listen to the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome, dear listener. We're up to episode 73 of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. It's the 30th of November, 2016. With me is the 12th man. Normally, Paul, I would ask, how are you? But I do know, in fact, that you are recovering from a bit of a throat infection.
Yes.
But welcome aboard for another episode.
Thank you, Trevor. Thank you, listeners. Hi to all my friends in the swamp.
So, Paul, later on, we will continue our discussion of the general store in the remote Queensland and, you know, should they be forced to serve a black person?
Should they indeed.
So we'll get to that, but we'll do a few other topics between now and then. First up, article from The Age. The Greens and the One Nation Party have got together and are putting to Parliament some legislation which would mean that, well, our current situation is that basically the Prime Minister and Cabinet decide whether we go to war or not. And we've mentioned before in this podcast that it's an extraordinary power to have, and really, the Prime Minister and the War Cabinet, which is just traditionally Foreign and Defence Ministers and a few others, they would make a preliminary decision and then they would take it to Cabinet, and that's the end of the matter. And as I said before, like, the most pathetic piece of legislation, they have to negotiate with all sorts of people to get it through the Parliament, yet off we go to war at the drop of a hat based on the opinions of two or three people.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
It is. Mm. So full marks to the Greens and to One Nation.
Indeed.
Who are...
a rare tick.
Yes. Who are bringing this legislation forward. So it's... there was a Victorian campaigner called Michael Smith, and he has walked from his hometown of Chewton to Canberra carrying the proposed legislation. So there's a few people who have in the past supported this idea. Former Army Chief Peter Leahy has long called for parliamentary debate.
Wow.
Defence scholar and former Army officer James Brown is a prominent advocate.
The not the music star.
James, no, Brown. Not that James Brown, no. Both of those characters I just mentioned, they argue that the executive, namely the Prime Minister and a handful of others, should make a preliminary decision with Parliament then reviewing the deployment within strictly set timelines. But I reckon, sure, if there's a missile heading our way, send a missile the other way. But in the absence of that, surely we can just gather together our politicians and discuss in Parliament at fairly short notice. So I think that's a really good move. Very happy about that.
Yeah, it sounds constructive to me because, as you say, it's an extraordinary situation where just a handful of people get to commit the whole country to an incredibly consequential act of sending and, you know, deploying Australians to go off and potentially die. And as we know, in the last couple of wars, they did in significant numbers and killed others.
Mm.
Yes, I agree. So there should be more deliberation and some kind of formal process that they have to go through.
Mm. We have mentioned just recently that with Donald Trump coming into the presidency of the United States, that maybe this is our opportunity to change our alliance with the United States. Because in the past, it's been a case of the US telling us to jump and us asking how high would they like. And now, with Donald Trump going to be in charge, perhaps we'll stop and we'll say, well, hang on a minute, this is Donald Trump. We better actually think about this. So that would be a good thing. Very interesting article from the John Menadue blog, Future of the US Alliance. A whole series of articles that they've done recently. This one is part 3. And in it, John Menadou looks at what Malcolm Fraser had to say. So Malcolm Fraser, in his book Dangerous Allies, warned us that we can be drawn into US conflicts that are of no immediate concern to us. He warned of dangerous strategic dependence on the US. And a few interesting statistics here, 12th man. Since its independence in 1776, the US of A has been at war 93% of the time since 1776. They've been at war.
Incredible, isn't it?
Yep. There's a link to a site for this. The US has never had a decade without war. They've launched 201 out of 248 armed conflicts since the end of World War II. The US is responsible for 41% of the world's total military spending, and they maintain over 700 military bases around the world in more than 100 countries. It's just a business for America. And it's a business for so many people who are involved in the business that it's just self-perpetuating. A powerful study of Latin America between 1898 and 1994, so 104 years. Historian John Coatsworth counts 41 cases of successful US-led regime change for an average rate of one government overthrow by the US every 28 months for a century.
Well, shouldn't we be applauding their success? Or their success rate?
Well, they overthrow and put other useless despot in, so they end up having to overthrow, you know, later on. Yeah, so it's the whole... That's the whole Iran story. Like, that was the whole Shah of Iran situation where they overthrew Mossadegh and...
Yeah.
And look where we are today. So,
but you know what they used to say about overthrowing despots in Latin America, don't you?
No.
And installing a new bastard. They used to say he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch.
Well, for about 6 months until he gets control of the military and does what he wants, and then they and makes some communist noises.
Happened in Noriega, the last one that crossed them.
Yeah. Well, put it this way: 41 cases. In Latin America, there must have been a number of them where they just threw out the guy they'd only recently put in. So anyway, there's an entire powerful military-industrial complex in the US of a union of defense contractors and armed forces. And Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, a Republican, said, "Does the number of warships we have and are building really put America at risk when the US battle fleet is larger than the next 13 navies combined, 11 of which are our partners and allies?" It's just a war machine that they've got going there, and we are jumping on and joining them on every occasion so far.
And another important factor that is often... fails to be mentioned, not by us of course, is the Christianization of the American military. Apparently evangelical Christianity is very, very strong in the US military, and apparently I've read reports by service personnel who claim they were discriminated against basically if they didn't join in the God thing.
Right, I doubt it. Well, George Bush himself, or Junior, he claimed he was on a mission from God when he invaded Iraq, so...
He did.
So that's the calibre of people we're following in. So Eisenhower warned of a powerful military complex. That includes the Pentagon, members of Congress who are dependent on defense spending in their states, arms manufacturers across the country, the intelligence community, and so-called independent think tanks that depend on defense and military supplies for funding. So all of these groups, it's in their interest to keep the whole show going because they've got jobs, that businesses that rely on it. And we've only got to see a case in Australia, 12th man, of one one man with a vested interest in a job can cost our government $50 million. Have you heard of the European fox controversy in Tasmania?
Yes.
So the hint seems to be, through the media, that there's perhaps one or two, they're suggesting...
Insiders
in the European fox eradication unit who have been...
smuggling fox corpses into Tasmania.
Correct. And fox poo. Into Tasmania, and then going, oh, look, we found some evidence here in this area. We better do some more investigating.
Funding for action here.
Yes. So seemingly nobody has ever seen a live fox in Tasmania, but potentially one person with a vested interest in maintaining the business of fox hunting has cost us $50 million since 2001.
All change.
So, upscale that to a bunch of Americans with, who are making military equipment and
selling it to us.
Yes. So,
we like their expensive bits too, don't we? We like their expensive warplanes and missiles and bombs and ships.
So, as Paul Keating recently said, we need to grow up and become more independent.
But you don't want us to buy any more and too many submarines. How can we be independent without our own 12 submarines?
Well, we don't have to buy them from America, for starters. So, I say we buy submarines, but we buy cheap ones.
Yeah, so, I say we buy nuclear-powered ones, as they were designed to be.
Okay, and why would we want nuclear-powered ones?
Because that's what they were designed as. Apparently, they have a far longer, far greater range, operating range.
Yes.
Without any need to refuel.
Correct, yes.
And we have the fuel.
And why would we be wanting to operate long range?
To protect our shores.
So wouldn't that mean close range?
Australia has a big coastline. That's... Even close range requires long range. How many submarine bases can we afford to build and protect?
So, well, here's the strategy. If you are going to hug your own coastline or within the vicinity of it, and you're going to wait for the enemy to attack, then what you really want is a very small, very quiet submarine that can just lurk in relatively shallow waters and be extremely silent, wait for the enemy to approach, and then shoot them, right?
But you don't know where the enemy is going to approach on such a large coastline.
Yes, you do, because you've got all sorts of surveillance stuff that is telling you there's a convoy of Chinese troop ships heading your way. Like, it's not that hard, is it?
They can change course, Trevor.
Yes.
So does your little submarine chase
them?
Well,
I've got 12 of them lined up, okay?
12 little submarines.
Yes.
Okay.
And they're just sitting and lurking and waiting, and they're extremely quiet. Now, you're in charge of a Chinese troop ship, and you've got 10,000 Chinamen on there. You're going to be as nervous as all...
It's very provocative, calling them Chinese.
Well, this is what we're getting to. I mean, who's going to invade us? This is who we're talking about. So, the nuclear sub. So you've got me on a sub rant, and I can't help myself.
Good.
12 men. But a nuclear sub, you use that if you're going to attack China.
Oh, no. We wouldn't attack China, of course.
No, we wouldn't. So we don't want a nuclear submarine. Because you only want long-range capability if you're going to go into the South China Sea and launch missiles at China. That's when you need a big long-range sub.
I don't know about that. You may be right, but...
The other thing is you want to be nice and quiet when you're waiting for the enemy.
Are nuclear submarines not quiet?
No, because they continually have to have a coolant operating. So they're actually noisier than a conventional powered one where you can absolutely shut everything off and just go into battery. They're actually noisier. I convinced you, 12th man, that if our true purpose is defensive rather than offensive... Mm. And if a little sub costs $600 million as opposed to $4 billion, mm-hmm. and I'm still saying we could have 12 of them if you really want 12.
I want 12.
Okay. Then what do you reckon?
Yeah, I'm open to persuasion. Absolutely.
Well, haven't I persuaded you?
You're getting
what,
there.
What? Where does my argument fall down?
I don't want to surrender too easily.
But where does it fall down?
It doesn't fall down. I'm just trying to...
So at this point, you'd have to say, Iron Fist, I agree with you. In the absence of a counter-argument, you're right.
Iron Fist, you're being very persuasive today.
Yes. And if you had to make the decision, which way would you jump? If you're in charge of our defence force right at this moment... Look,
before making such an important decision, I'd like to sit down and see all the details.
Yeah, but if this is all that's been presented, you know, at this very moment, if somebody said to you, what's your position, what would it be?
You know, I don't like being rushed on such important decisions, but yeah, you have a point. You make a good point.
Right. All right. You're a hard man to convince. I'm just warming up, you see, for our general store in remote Queensland. I'm trying to get you to agree on an easy one. All right. Noel Pearson. Let's talk about Noel.
Good old Noel.
He's been in the news. He's had a go at the ABC. He's lambasted the ABC as miserable and racist during a speech in Sydney. He said the media aided and abetted ignorant ministers and malign bureaucrats to wreck promising reforms. Not the least, the country's miserable, racist national broadcaster, a spittoon's worth of perverse people willing the wretched to fail, says Noel Pearson. They need blacks, he's talking about the ABC here, they need blacks to remain alienated from mothers' bosoms, incarcerated in legions, leading short lives of grief and tribulation, because if it were not so, against whom could they direct their soft bigotry of low expectations? About whom could they report of misery and bleeding tragedy? What is going on with Noel Pearson?
I mean, that is such bloated rhetoric, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Seriously, Noel, who's right? Does he steal the best lines from everybody else's sort of overblown speech?
It's just...
The bigotry of low expectations, of course, is quite a common turn of phrase these days, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Particularly used against,
yes.
Social justice warriors, as we sometimes call them.
Yes. But where does this come from? Like, the ABC is extremely sympathetic to the Aboriginal cause and very open to showing the problems that are going on in communities, and
the ABC and SBS are really the most open, the most diverse in their programming, aren't they?
I mean, if you came up to the ABC with a program about, you know, the plight of Aboriginals, that would be the first thing they're going to tick and approve compared to any other topic.
Look at Four Corners.
Yes.
I mean, they were ruthless in their examination of certain issues related to Aboriginal Indigenous rights
Yes. So it seems that Noel Pearson's not happy because his programs get criticised from the left and from the right, and he's
Is he suffering from sort of relevance deficit or something?
Well, I think he's just angry when he gets criticised and doesn't like it. So in response to that, a very good article by a guy called Clive Hamilton, who's a professor of public ethics, Centre for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics at Charles Sturt University. I like this his article here. For years, Noel Pearson has been using people like me as a punching bag, and I'm sick of it. Having cajoled and bullied one government after another into pouring millions into his pet schemes, thereby depriving more worthy Indigenous projects of funds, they have failed, failed and failed again. And so he resorts to type, casting around for someone to blame, venting his seemingly bottomless rage against everyone who does not praise his vision.
Indeed.
And
we're all racists. If it isn't working out for Noel...
Yep.
There must be racists behind it. Not only that, but you'd be aware, Iron Fist, that Noel wants to see the Christian Bible translated into Indigenous languages.
It does. Very important to him.
Now, how on earth is that going to benefit Indigenous people?
They'll get to know Jesus.
It's a strange one, isn't it?
You know, if that goes by without a single complaint, yet if you were to say to Indigenous people, you know, the key problem is here is your attachment to the land. If you're going to live in just a remote, out-of-the-way place, then you're really putting a straitjacket on yourself as far as participating in the modern civilised world is concerned. So,
and like the gay teaching couple, you might have to accept some limitations to your lifestyle.
Yes. Well, let's not confuse things at the moment with your other example. You can raise that later. But if you were to say that, you know, oh, well, Aborigines should move away from these remote areas and go to somewhere a bit more cosmopolitan for jobs and opportunities and all the rest of the rich things that modern life can provide, they would say to you, well, that's just totally ignoring the cultural needs of the Aboriginal people. Yet on the other hand, introduce the Christian faith to these people, which is got nothing to do with Aboriginal culture and totally against the spirit world of the animism type.
Totally in conflict with their so-called spiritual beliefs.
Yes.
Totally in conflict. In fact, it negates their spiritual beliefs.
Yes. But that's okay. Isn't it?
Yeah, so, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yes. So anyway, so we digressed on the Bible then. But just in terms of the language that he used, because he was speaking, Noel Pearson, at a book launch for a biography of Paul Keating. This article, still by Clive Hamilton. There he was again the other day at a book launch, wheeling out his wearying form of faux Martin Luther King oratory. You would have liked that.
Yeah.
Mother's bosoms, carceral in legions, bleeding tragedy. Give me a break.
Yeah.
This is not soaring rhetoric, but pompous twaddle in search of a scapegoat.
I tend to agree.
Mm.
Yeah, it's really, it's just so overladen with this heavy descriptive language, isn't it?
Mm. Yes.
You know, emotive language, I meant to say.
Yes.
But it's like he's plucked every highly emotive phrase from every speech he's heard in the last 20 years.
Yes.
And put it together and said, wow, that'll be great.
And trying to sound grandiose, but when you actually look at the content of it, you just think to yourself, that just doesn't ring true at all. It
doesn't ring true at all, as you say. Look, I'm a big fan of the ABC, I have to say, and I'm forever finding myself defending the ABC, even to my own family, who sometimes are persuaded that the ABC is too left. I can't see it myself, but anyway.
Mm. If only we had right-wing Tony here at the moment, he would give a few ABC comments. But anyway, he goes on in that article basically saying that Pearson is just a bully most of the time, saying, and that really he doesn't have support within the larger Aboriginal community.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment, isn't it? I wasn't aware of that, but I don't follow the the politics of or Indigenous politics that closely, I have to say.
So one of the few supporters is Rachel Perkins, who is the daughter of Charles Perkins. She admires his courage, not least because he is fearless in confronting Aboriginal people themselves and being hated by them for it. This guy makes the comment that if Pearson is trying to emulate Martin Luther King, then he's missing the mark because Martin Luther King was never hated by his own people, even though he was working hard for change for them. So yeah, I used to like the sound of Noel Pearson years ago, but since we've been doing this podcast, we've found a few articles about him and thought,
He was a very idealistic as a young activist.
I think because he was prepared to criticise leftist ideals, it was refreshing. And people like Tony Abbott supported him because of that. But at the end of the day, I just don't think what he pushes in terms of policies is actually doing the job. So that's Noel Pearson. 12th man. We've previously talked about a scenario. We were talking about the gay wedding cakes.
Mm-hmm.
So a bakery normally makes wedding cakes, asked to make one for a gay couple, says no. And you said, well, they shouldn't have to. And I was trying to find examples where people might be forced to do something and see if I could get you to agree to that at least. And I gave the example of a general store in outback, you know, very remote Queensland, only store in town, refuses to serve black people. And I said to you, they should be forced to sell to black, white, or polka dot people. And if the law of the land should be that they have to, and if they don't want to do that, they shouldn't be in that sort of business.
Yeah.
Your position at the time was, no, shouldn't be forced to do that. That market forces will operate, that people will refuse to use that business, and that's all we need. We don't need laws written for that.
Yeah.
Do you still maintain that position?
Look, I still maintain the position that there's got to be a better way of shaping public morality than the blunt instrument of the law. But yeah, look, you know, I'm certainly sympathetic to the idea that if that's the only store in town and it is, yeah, it's a case of clear racial discrimination, then yes, perhaps there is a place for the law in that. But
right,
yeah.
So in certain circumstances.
But the problem therein is, you know, who's deciding? Who's deciding who is what race, you know?
Well, you don't have to decide, because you say you have to serve everyone.
Yeah, regardless.
Yes.
Okay. So then the store owner, yeah, I suppose, decides it's not because of race, it's because I don't like that person's...
If they're a human being, they have to serve them, we say. So there's no decision-making to be done.
But decency would say that, yes, they should serve anybody who walks through the door, so long as they're well-behaved and civil and, you know.
Right. Yeah. So, okay, so we've got that point with the general store and in the remote area.
Mm-hmm. But the marriage celebrant, I don't know, I'm not...
So let's go back then to the bakery with the, you know, they make wedding cakes all the time.
Did you see my example of the bakery on the website?
No.
Okay, I came up with another one.
Oh, okay.
I said, what if a gay Polynesian couple fronts up at a Muslim halal bakery who specializes in Muslim wedding cakes and says, can you bake us a wedding cake for our Polynesian wedding? And, you know, they don't even have to be gay, in fact. And they say, we want it decorated with a traditional Polynesian tableau, you know, featuring a traditional Polynesian feast with lots of roast pigs.
Yes.
On the wedding cake. And the halal baker says, sorry, we don't do pigs here.
Yes.
Should he be punished?
No.
Why not?
Because the argument would be, we make halal products and we will sell them to whoever wants to buy our halal product. So that's what we make, and whoever walks in the door will get that.
Okay, so the Polynesian couple say, that's fine with us. You don't have to put any real pig fat in the ingredients. Use whatever ingredients you like. We just want that beautiful tableau on the wedding cake showing the Polynesian feast with the roast pigs. There's no halal ingredients in it. Yes. No haram ingredients in it, I should say.
Yes.
And he still refuses.
Because he doesn't want to deal with an image of a pig as such.
It's just an image.
Hmm. Hmm.
There's absolutely no ingredient in it that is violating his religious principles. They say, no, no. We've even found our own recipe.
Yes.
You can make it all with completely halal ingredients.
See, you're going so far beyond what they would normally offer as part of their service that you're really asking them to do something quite different to their normal
job. If it's the only wedding
cake? When we're talking about the traditional argument about the wedding cake people is the cake is what they always make. The icing is what they always make. The only difference is that as they've got the flute or whatever it is of cream where they're doing a bit of decorating, that at that point they're going or they're sticking two male figurines on the cake. So you're not asking somebody to do something fundamentally different from what they're always doing. So the example you seem to be doing is saying I want an Indian restaurant to serve me a Chinese meal. That seemed to be where you were.
I don't think
your
so.
Example was.
I don't think so. No, because
if the substantive product is exactly the same, we're just talking about a little bit of decoration on top.
The gay wedding cake was only about decoration, wasn't it?
Yes.
What's the difference between them putting two boys on top of a wedding cake instead of a boy and a girl? What's the difference between putting a few pigs on top instead of a few camels or goats or whatever they might put?
I don't see that that would be a genuine request by those people. That wouldn't be genuine. That's clearly... Nobody wants a couple of pigs on their wedding cake as their decoration.
You don't know. Have you ever been to a Polynesian feast? I went to one once and they had like 50 roast sucking pigs.
Of course they did, but they didn't have little miniature ones on the wedding cake. So,
well, it wasn't a wedding, but you know, but potentially it's possible, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that to me seemed a very convoluted example where you're asking people to do something quite different to what they normally would do in a very substantive way. Like you're giving them a new recipe for a cake, for goodness sake. You're telling them how to make a cake.
Not giving them a new recipe, just asking them to do a different decoration. Right. Just like the gay bakery in the United States.
Okay, we'll put it this way. If it's a Muslim bakery, and so they should be doing...
A Muslim bakery that is serving the general public is what I'm saying.
Yes.
Not just serving Muslims.
Yes.
A Muslim bakery that is open to the general public.
Yeah.
And a couple
of... They make wedding cakes every day of the week. There are all sorts of people.
We just want you to change the decoration, just like the Christian bakers were asked to change the decoration. What's different about it?
Well, I don't have a problem with that. I think they should, if it's just a matter of changing the decoration, but just the example you gave of a couple of pigs sound authentic.
Well, to me, the Muslims' objection to decorating the top of the wedding cake with pigs...
Yeah.
It's not very different, really, essentially, to the Christian baker who doesn't want to decorate the top of the cake with two men. You know, it's just decoration.
Mm.
There's nothing substantive in it, really, is there?
Okay, I don't have a problem in saying that they have to decorate the cake.
So you would punish them with the law? You see, I would give them both freedom,
right?
To refuse and say, "Look, I'm sorry, it's not really what we do."
Muslim shop assistant who says, "Well, I'm not handling that ham through the register."
What ham?
So, you know...
In a delicatessen. Yes. Well, in that case, the shop assistant shouldn't have taken the job if he knew he was going to have to handle ham.
Bakery shouldn't have taken the job.
If he knew he was going to have to decorate Polynesian wedding cakes.
Correct. that's the whole point of these things. If you're the general store in remote Queensland, if you don't want to serve everyone who's potentially going to walk in the shop, don't open a general store.
Mm.
If you're not prepared to serve the general public, don't be in business. Do something else.
Yeah, and that's a sensible position to take. Mm. But is it something that should be enforced by the law, is my point. You see, I'm just reluctant.
Mm. You're reluctant to force people to do things.
To bring everything down to legal sanction, you know?
Yes. Mm.
That's it. That's my point.
Yes. Oh, well, we've moved on from the... at least I got you on the general store remote. You've come around on that one.
Yeah, I am pretty uncomfortable with a general store refusing people on the basis that they look different. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Everyone needs to stop talking about white people. Article from Spiked magazine. The editor, Brendan O'Neill.
Mm. He's a terrific writer, Brendan O'Neill, don't
you
think? Yes,
he is. He speaks very well, too, when interviewed.
Did you see him last time he was on Q&A?
I no longer watch Q&A. I just can't stand it. I'll watch the replay excerpts when I hear something particularly offensive that I want to...
Look, I watch it because it gives me fuel, you know?
Right, yeah.
Really, it gets me...
Charges your batteries.
It charges my batteries. And it helps me to analyse more clearly my objections to some of the so-called progressive lefts that regularly appear on it.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to be the sort of default position for a lot of people who see themselves as progressives, isn't it?
Yes.
To denigrate anyone who even suggests there might be another way of looking at things than the way that they look at it.
Yes. Than the orthodox left of you.
And O'Neill is terrific. He's totally fearless, isn't he?
He is.
He just jumps straight in and says, what about this?
Yes.
You know? Why can't you see it a different way? Yes. And they're all like, oh my God, he said it, you know? Yes. And they come out with the usual abuse, you know, insult him. He's a bigot, he's a racist, you know? I mean...
Yes.
But he's... intellectually a very sharp guy.
Yes.
And he, you know, he has no hesitation in giving his own background. He grew up as a committed Marxist, but I think he's tempered his Marxism quite a lot.
Yeah.
And now he just tries to cut through all the bullshit.
Yes.
From whichever part of politics it's coming from.
Yes.
And tries to focus more. He's definitely focused on class politics more than anything.
Yeah. I don't know, that last episode, I think because you said, you know, you've got to watch that bit of Q&A at the end, and I did watch it, and there was the Aboriginal woman who was an actor or comedian who was referring to something, and she said, well, as an Aboriginal woman, I can tell you that's racist.
Yeah, and what does that mean?
And had I been on the panel, I would have just turned to her and said, just because you're an Aboriginal woman doesn't make you an expert on what's racist. Like, tell me why it's racist. What are the elements of racism? And how does this fulfill those elements? And but just merely stating something is taken to have been proof of
what she was saying was part of this idea that some non-white people seem to think if you're non-white, you have an inbuilt racism detector.
Yes.
You know, you don't have to study, you know, history, sociology, political theory, or anything.
Yes. You just got to feel it.
You just got to feel it.
Yeah.
And you know it.
Yeah.
If you hear racism, you just know it's racism without any theoretical underpinnings whatsoever.
Yes. And woe to any white man who might consider having a contrary opinion from a position of privilege. How would you know if you've never been subjected to racism, what racism is?
Yeah.
If you're not a victim...
Check your privilege,
Trump. Man, if you're not a victim, then how would you know...
Oh, it's maddening, isn't it?
Anyway, so one paragraph from this article by Brendan O'Neill. The white people obsession turns whiteness into a kind of original sin, a marker for wickedness. To be white is to be corrupted from the moment of birth, and so one must spend one's time atoning and apologising. This is why we have the cult of white privilege checking, where well-educated, racially minded, progressive whites will ostentatiously watch what they say around blacks, take a back seat in debates about race and power, and preface their every utterance with the words, I know I'm white, so this might be invalid, but...
Yeah.
Dot, dot, dot. Hmm. Yeah. Well, we're not about to fall into that trap, are we, talk man?
Not in a hurry.
No. We're going to go
out... We'll maintain our white male rage.
That's it. Part of that topic, 12th Man, is critical thinking.
Yes.
And there was an article, again linked to, dear listener, all these articles that we talk about on this program, if you go to the website, there are links to them, so you can look them up yourself if you're interested. This one was talking about whether universities are actually teaching critical thinking, and it called into question whether they really are. Certainly, employers rate it highly as something that they want to see in their employees. But the bit I liked about this this article, 12th Man, was just definitions for critical thinking. Mm. And they go four of them. Reflective and reasonable thinking that is focused on deciding what to believe or do. Well, that was okay.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to analyse facts, generate and organise ideas, defend opinions, make comparisons, draw inferences, evaluate arguments and solve problems. Well, that's pretty good. The whole nature of that Q&A program, though, means you can't do any of that.
There's not a lot happening on Q&A sometimes.
This is the thing. When you've got a panel of six or seven people who all have to have their say, and then you've got a room full of people asking not necessarily connected questions, you can't have an examined, coherent line of argument because you're having to chop and change the players so much. So not many people are smart enough to take on what the person before them has said, carry that argument through, and hand the ball over to the next person to carry on the same argument, particularly when invariably you've got a member of the left, a member of the right, a member of the Liberals, a member of the Labour, who are all going to try and immediately turn whatever direction things were going in another direction. You can't have a proper argument. So that show just degenerates into I have a feeling sort of stuff.
Look, I agree with you. That program is not about critical thinking, but I think it has its place because at least it gets people talking and thinking about important issues, you know, or topical issues.
Yeah. A couple of other definitions here of critical thinking. The awareness of a set of interrelated critical questions plus the ability and willingness to ask and answer them at appropriate times. And the final one I really liked, definition of critical thinking, thinking about your thinking while you're thinking to make your thinking better.
Indeed. That's an important one.
That was a good one.
Yeah.
Mm. So query whether that's actually happening in universities.
Checking for confirmation bias.
Mm.
Dear listener, not too long ago, you looked at your podcast app and saw that a new episode of the Iron Fist and Velvet Glove podcast was available to download. Did you silently think to yourself, great, a new podcast. I like listening to those guys. If so, then you qualify as a potential donor to the podcast. Your donation will help cover some expenses, but more importantly, your donation tells the boys that they are on the right track and to keep up the good work. $1 a show is all they ask. Go to their website at ironfistvelvetglove.com.au and click on the donations link.
Oh, we've already had a submarine discussion, and I had a little bit here from John Menadue again. This submarine project that you're so fond of, 12th Man, less than 2,000 people will be employed for $50 billion. That's an effective rate of protection of 300%. We used to have an automobile manufacturing industry. It had a rate of protection of 8% and employed 200,000 people, but just gave that away.
What do you think about that? Because the claim is made by the Labour Party that every automotive industry in the world gets government assistance. I personally don't have a problem with it if it keeps people, a lot of people, and obviously it did keep a lot of people employed.
Mm.
And not only that, but it had a flow-on benefits for other related industries, in not only in manufacturing, but in technology and related matters, you know. I thought it was worth it. What did you think?
For the security of our country, we need to be able to make things.
And we need a diverse economy.
Yes.
If we become too specialised, we become extremely vulnerable.
Yes, if you're just a one-trick pony, then you're in trouble.
You're in trouble very quickly.
So we need a capacity to actually make stuff in case the whole world goes to kaput.
And it could do that.
So there's that argument. And the other one is, well, all these guys who are middle-aged, very difficult for them to find alternative employment. If we're just going to be paying them dole money, well, it would have been better to have been paying them a portion of their wage in a subsidy and having...
And keep them in work.
Yes.
And it's not just keeping them in work, you know, as
it's
a lot of people
say. All the subsequent issues of mental health and all
mental
the rest
health,
of it.
Mental health, self-esteem, you know.
Or, you know, I would have been okay if they had said, well, let's... If we're going to close this factory making cars, we're going to produce a factory making solar panels or something, you know, of that ilk would have been fine. Yeah. Wind turbine stuff, or I don't know, anything like that would have been fine.
Why not cars?
So, but not submarines when they're costing an absolute bomb. And the submarine corporation who's going to be doing the job are currently doing a job where they are... producing some ships, and they're consolidating three air warfare destroyers. It's been plagued with cost and delivery overruns. They're costing us $3 billion a ship, when an equivalent one from other parts of the world would have cost us $1 billion a ship. Mm. And,
Federal government...
wasting money.
Yep. It's got things back to front.
Mm. Canada and its very handsome young Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. Yes. What do you think of him?
Not very much, to be honest.
Why is that?
Well, he's just... Everything that comes out of his mouth is so predictably left progressive, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yes.
And... totally devoid of good rational basis, as far as I can tell.
Yes.
He seems to me to be a performer on a stage more than, you know, a true politician who thinks through the issues carefully and rationally and makes decisions accordingly. He's up there. He seems to have come from this, you know, new progressive left, and he's their new star, and he's going to deliver...
Yes.
What they want.
Yes.
And then everybody else can go to hell, and they may well do that.
Have you heard about his comments about Castro?
Yes.
Mm.
Very shallow.
Mm.
Extremely shallow.
So we've got a dictator who did some terrible things, and Prime Minister Trudeau issued a statement expressing deep sorrow over the death of Cuba's dictator, Fidel Castro.
Yeah.
He called Castro a larger-than-life leader and a legendary revolutionary and orator who made significant improvements to the education and healthcare of his island nation.
That's right. And yet if someone came out and said Germany in the 1920s and 30s produced an inspiring, charismatic leader...
Yes.
Who galvanized the nation, put the nation back to work, and reconstructed the country.
Yes. People would laugh. Yeah. So what's happened is people have been looking at other sort of world dictators and known baddies, and on Twitter with the hashtag Trudeau eulogies have been... producing fake eulogies in the spirit of Prime Minister Trudeau. And
quite funny, some of them.
Yes. Some of them, hashtag Trudeau eulogies. Here's some of them. While a controversial figure, Kim Jong-il's commitment to minimising North Korea's greenhouse gas emissions was admirable. It is with heavy heart that we mourn the passing of Saddam Hussein. His advancements in chemical research live on.
Yeah, indeed.
Though not universally liked by his compatriots, Mr. Ceausescu was a leader in urban design and affordable housing. As we mourn Emperor Caligula, let us always remember his steadfast devotion to Senate reform.
Yeah.
And while a controversial figure, even detractors recognise Pol Pot encouraged renewed contact between city and countryside.
He sure did that.
So Justin Trudeau, it's been all good news for him up until now. Drug legalisation, 12th man, you're in favour of it?
I am in favour of it.
Good. The Greens have changed their policy, and it more or less matches ours now.
Yeah, I think they're just copying us.
I think they have, because we basically said drugs should be legalised. Let's get a bunch of experts together and work out the best way of doing it with a view to legalising them. And there might be one or two that we shouldn't or whatever, but let's look at experiences around the world and stop this crazy war on drugs. And that seems to be the Greens' new push. But
there are doctors who've been saying this for 20 years or more.
Yes.
You know, doctors who specialise in treating people with dependency issues and and all the negative effects. And they've been saying, for goodness sake, you know, criminalising these people achieves nothing and just damages them further and keeps feeding money to criminals.
Yes. And a bit like the American military machinery, you have a machinery of drug enforcement, which people are relying on jobs, so they're going to be it's in their interest to maintain the war on drugs. But
there was an ex-Australian Federal Police, don't know if he was the commissioner, but he was very high in the Australian Federal Police. I saw him in the last, I don't know if it was in the last 12 months or 24 months, but he came out publicly strongly saying drugs should be decriminalised because for exactly the same reasons. He was very rational about it.
Was he recently retired?
I think he was, yes.
Yes. So
you recall it?
Yes, yeah. I do, yeah. He may well have had that position while still in the job, but it's kind of more likely when people are retired and they no longer have an empire to maintain
yeah.
and they don't have underlings requiring this.
I'm not sure whether somebody like him was maintaining an empire, but he was perhaps compelled to follow the official government
line. It would be very difficult for a police commissioner or somebody to advocate for different laws.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree with that. But interesting, the Australian Medical Association has come out criticising the new Greens policy.
Curious, isn't it?
And our deep throat, he let us know that I think his statistic was only about 27% of doctors are actually members of the AMA.
Yeah, I was surprised by that too.
Yes.
I would have thought it would be the majority. At least that was my assumption.
Yes. And he said, generally speaking, he felt that that would have been the older doctors and thereby more likely more conservative. So that's interesting because in the past, you know, if something came out of the AMA, I would have really held it in high regard.
Yeah.
Now knowing the sort of makeup of it, it just casts a different light.
Yeah, I always assumed the AMA represented the vast majority of doctors. Apparently not. Are there some other medical associations in Australia?
I don't know. We'll have to get Deep Throat on the show at some stage and find out. But good on you, Deep Throat, because that was invaluable information. So that was drug legalisation.
And a rare tick to Richard Di Natale and his crew.
Yes. Indeed. Yep.
We have to give credit where credit's due.
Yes. Rwanda genocide. What a mess that was.
Awful.
That's coming up to 20 years, I think.
Yes, it was 1994. So 22 years.
22 years. And unfortunately, the Catholic Church was heavily involved in the massacre. Members of the church did some terrible things. And just this week, the Catholic Church has apologised for the church's role in the genocide.
The statement acknowledged that church members planned, aided, and carried out the genocide in which more than 800,000 ethnic Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed by Hutu extremists. Many of the victims died at the hands of priests, clergymen, and nuns, according to some accounts by survivors. And the Rwandan government said many died in the churches where they sought refuge. There's an infamous case where a priest gathered people into a church and then directed the bulldozers to bulldoze the church with the people inside, and as they tried to escape, they were all shot. Like, terrible stuff.
Others had hand grenades thrown into them.
Just to give you an example of the just immorality of the Catholic Church, this is from 2014. The Roman Catholic priest at a medieval church an hour's drive from Paris, who has been indicted by the United Nations Court for genocide, extermination, murder, and rape in Rwanda. Oh, it's saying there is one. Father Wenceslas Munyeshyaka was notorious during the genocide. A Rwandan court convicted him of genocide and sentenced him in absentia to life imprisonment. And they spent years trying to bring him to trial, and he's happily operating as a Roman Catholic priest an hour's drive from Paris.
Wow. That's incredible.
Not an isolated case.
And the charges included rape?
Yes. Yes. So, a whole bunch of shifty characters from the Rwandan genocide made their way back to Europe and are operating as priests to this day.
I recall there were several Rwandan nuns who were indicted on charges.
Yes. Yeah.
So the maternal instinct didn't kick in too well, did it?
No. No, it did not.
So what do you think it was? Why would they, the Catholic Church, want to exterminate?
Well, for example, in the case of Wenceslas Munyeshyaka, I think he had a Hutu mother and a Tutsi father, and, you know, took one side in the dispute, and it was, you know, it's a racially based dispute.
Is there no religious element, I wonder?
Not especially. Really, no. No, it was a tribal issue in particular. And the Catholic Church was heavily involved in the mechanism of the government at the time.
Okay, which was dominated by the Hutu at the time.
Yes. And it was very much had its fingers in the pie, and I think this guy actually had a position in the government. And a lot of these priests and nuns who were Catholic were members of the Hutu tribe, for example. So their interests somehow
coincided.
Yeah, and, you know, supposedly the moral direction that they would have got from being Catholic provided no help at all in saying to them, you know what, you probably shouldn't kill these Tutsis. Yeah, so...
genocide.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't recall anything. Although, let's face it, in the Old Testament, there are a number of cases of genocide directed by God or his emissaries.
Mm.
So perhaps, you know, they got their precedents from the Bible.
Perhaps they were taking a literal interpretation.
Maybe they thought that they were reenacting a biblical prophecy on earth in this current day and age.
Yes, who knows what their thinking was, but it was more of a tribal thing. It wasn't that much of a religious motivation, but the point is, supposedly being so religious with such moral fiber, it was of no use at all, and they committed the atrocities anyway. So there we go. Well, Twelfth Man, we've come up to the hour mark. My wife gets very annoyed with me if I go over, so we'll finish up. Thank you for battling through your throat infection.
Always a pleasure.
Very good. And thank you, dear listener. We will talk to you next week. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.